which could take place under false accusations and not be based on legal criteria. It also identified some of those who have been handed down death sentences. These individuals include Yusuf al-Mansaf, Abdul-Majid al-Namr, Javad Qariris, Muhammad al-Faraj, Hassan Zaki al-Faraj, and Ali Hassan al-Subaiti. Since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, hundreds of bloggers, intellectuals and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have also been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, freedom of association and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's legal authorities. Over the past years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activism and dissent. The Conversation website has also covered the same story and tells us more. Saudi Arabia recently sentenced Noura bint Saeed al-Qahtani to 45 years in prison after she had expressed her views on social media sites. This comes just a couple of weeks after a Leeds University student, Salma al-Shahab, was sentenced to 34 years in prison for using Twitter to retweet views of activists who are critical of the country. There had been a few small signs that Saudi Arabia had been offering its women a few more freedoms in the past few years, but recent harsh prison sentences against women activists have sparked increased debate about the country's human rights abuses. Despite these cases, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman was invited to Queen Elizabeth II's funeral, although in the end, a government minister attended in his place. The fiancé of murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Hatice Cengiz, criticised the invitation of Mohammed bin Salman and its implications that the United Kingdom and the international community were turning a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's excesses. One factor that means that the West is less likely to criticise Saudi Arabia right now is the war in Ukraine. However, the imprisonment of these two women is just an intensification of long-term oppression of women in Saudi Arabia by the regime, while the West looks the other way. The Trump administration avoided the issue, refraining from criticizing Saudi Arabia's human rights record. Donald Trump made Saudi Arabia part of his first foreign trip and further affirmed the US's long-standing policy of keeping a close partnership with Saudi Arabia. The Obama administration was more critical and raised some concerns over human rights in Saudi Arabia, though it still maintained a stable working relationship with the Saudis. Britain, as another key global actor, has more or less followed the same trajectory as the United States. It cooperates with Saudi Arabia on a variety of matters, politically, militarily, economically, and even selling Saudi Arabia arms that the latter then has used to indiscriminately kill people in Yemen. Saudi Arabia has had one of the poorest human rights records in the world for decades. Some would argue that the West has been letting Saudi Arabia get away with it with human rights violations for many years.
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the history of Qasr edifice, the story of a museum that has had so many ups and downs dependent to the different utilization of the place. The journey from a luxurious palace which was converted to a dreadful political prison and is now a museum. The story of the Ghasr edifice is intertwined with some of the most turbulent and crucial years of Iran's history. And within the confines of its walls, it holds countless memories of suffering and struggle. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the documentary.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Ghasr prison.
During the time the prisoner was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's why some families knew their children were there.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davood Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Ghasr prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
Savak's harassment and torture accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger and continued the struggle to overthrow the decadent regime.
In 1974, student activities intensified and street demonstrations flared up. With draconian power, Savak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents. Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Ghasr prison and others were overcrowded.
Inside prisons, clerics would shoulder a special burden to teach young prisoners and broaden their horizons.
Prominent religious scholars like Ayatollah Taleghani and others tried to attract other people rather than to reject them. Even a person who had caved in a little to Savak torture would get ablaze when associated with such great people.
Savak, long suspicious of clerics' activities in prisons and afraid of their success, began to hold them back.
Up to the year 1974, the circumstances were desirable for political prisoners because there was no separation between them. For example, Mr. Taleghani and other prominent figures were all in the same prison, with a young man sentenced to a few months for distributing communiques. Such a man would mix with them and get trained by them. The political prison had become the university of the revolution. But after the year 1974, most of the religious scholars were transferred to Evin Penitentiary, to a place specifically for religious scholars in order to disconnect their relations with other prisons so as to prevent them from growing.
Identifying different political and ideological currents in prisons and sowing discord among prisoners were on the list of Savak's priorities. The main aim was to pit opposition leaders against one another, tarnish their reputations and drain them of power so they couldn't fight the regime.
What is Savak? خیلی تبلیغ میکرد و تحریک میکرد افراد رو که
Savak itself would provoke prisoners to discuss with each other and pit them against each other. So it was probable that a problem would rise between those people, and the winner was Savak. So to avoid such a thing inside prison, the prisoners tried to keep their unity, saying, "We have a common enemy, and in front of this common enemy, we have to be united and must not provide Savak with excuses."
By arresting political dissidents, Savak aimed to quench the raging flames of the revolution. But since almost all political prisoners were transferred to Tehran, the prisons became a hive of political activity. The prisoners were filled in on the latest gossip, news, or instructions and announcements issued by Ayatollah Khomeini by their families, who would visit them from every corner of the nation.
The best point of this prison had to do with meetings. A long, narrow corridor, a wall about 1 meter in height, with rails and nettings, and a distance of 1 meter with officers in between.
When they came here, they would stand behind bars, prisoners on this side. Imagine such a large number of visitors who wanted to talk to prisoners all at the same time in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, all of them wanted to talk and tell their things. How was it possible for them to do so in 10 minutes? That's while some prisoners and families had to exchange political information from inside and outside the prison.
Mr. Mansouri believes political prisoners have always been well informed about the country's affairs.
After all, political prisoners would try regularly to be up to date and have the best analysis of the issues. It may be interesting to know that we in prison knew much more about the country's issues than those who were outside prison. The reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave Savak more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, Savak stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does.
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture.
Not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked...
Not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
Within, I want to be very careful, not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. Above all, the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
The human rights must be absolute, but let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
During the U.S. presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were U.S. pawns to open political space and improve the image of the U.S.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new U.S. president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, "Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible." Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space, rather than diffusing the situation, helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the US had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government. But in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before. The US didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since SAVAK had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not to the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and SAVAK agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garden Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude. But when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Qasr Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place that's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. a witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
Well, with the drastic changes the edifice witnessed in the past 200 years, one can only wonder what will become of it 200 years from now. And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
British Petroleum, known as BP, has cut its climate pledges while reporting record-shattering profits. According to reports, BP is planning more fossil fuel output than expected after reporting a record $28 billion in profits for 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted in this regard, BP, a London-based oil giant that has attempted to style itself as a leader of the renewable energy transition, announced recently that it is slashing its emission reduction goals and planning more fossil fuel output than previously expected, after reporting a record $28 billion in profits for 2022, more than double what it made the year before. Compared to its earlier plan to curtail fossil fuel production by 40% below 2019 levels, the company said it now intends to cut output by just 25% by 2030. BP correspondingly now aims for a fall of 20% to 30% in emissions from the carbon in its oil and gas production in 2030, compared to a 2019 baseline lower than the previous aim of 35 to 40%, the company said in a press release. The oil giant also said it plans to pour just as much money, up to $8 billion, into its fossil fuel businesses as its so-called transition growth engines, which include renewables by 2030. BP's announcement came a day after the head of the United Nations said fossil fuel companies that can't establish credible plans to sharply reduce carbon emissions should not be in business. We need a renewable revolution, not a self-destructive fossil fuel resurgence, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. BP's decision to scale down its climate goals drew the ire of campaigners and scientists who stressed that growing fossil fuel production is imperiling global hopes of having and staving off even more catastrophic warming. Just when we need to be rolling back oil and gas production, BP is rolling back its climate commitments, said Doug Parr, Greenpeace UK's chief scientist, adding, "Don't let the spin disguise it. This looks like BP edging back to being a traditional oil company." Climate scientist Bill Maguire argued BP's announcement further demonstrates that fossil fuel companies can't be trusted to voluntarily cut production and potentially sacrifice short-term profits for the sake of the climate, no matter how splashly their pledges and rebrands. BP cuts its emissions pledge and plans a greater production of oil and gas over the next 7 years compared with previous targets, Maguire tweeted, adding, "This is criminal. Fossil fuel cores must be forced to stop drilling. It is our only chance now." BP is the latest oil and gas behemoth to report record-shattering profits for 2022, a banner year for fossil fuel companies, thanks in large part to the ongoing energy market impacts of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. In its fourth quarter earnings announcement, BP said it would boost its dividend and buy back an additional $2.75 billion worth of its own shares. The company repurchased $11.25 billion of its stock last year. "Importantly, we are delivering for our shareholders with buybacks and a growing dividend," BP CEO Bernard Looney said in a statement, adding, "This is exactly what we said we would do and will continue to do, performing while transforming." Freya Atchison, oil and gas campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, called BP's profits sickening and said fossil fuel giants are being allowed to bank billions in profits whilst millions of ordinary people struggle to pay their bills. Atchison added, "Bosses and shareholders at these big polluters are being allowed to get even richer by profiteering from one of our most basic needs. The harm caused by the fossil fuel energy system couldn't be clearer." Saying these companies are not serious about climate action or transitioning away from oil and gas, "The evidence shows they are spending just a tiny fraction of their profits into truly green projects."
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance. Spring of Truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar. February 1st, 1979. Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. You have gained victory through your exceptional efforts in unity of expression. Of course, as the first step, your victory is now in the initial stage, in as much as you have swept aside from the scene the main traitor, named Muhammad Reza, although it is said that he is making frantic effort abroad. Even now that his own masters have cerned him and are not allowing him entry, he is seeking help from some of his likes in order to find a way out of his predicament. But he is thinking in vain to be able to hold the reins of power once again after this dynasty's 50 years of treachery and after 30 or so years of crimes and treason committed by these treacherous men against this country, pushing it backward. He has transformed our country's culture into a culture of colonialism.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. This is Ali, and we are trying to present some of the sayings of the late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, on the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, in a saying says that the final victory is when Islam, in all dimensions, and its rulings, is being established in Iran. And the greater victory is that Islam rulings in all regions of the world. And the greater victory is that when Islamic rulings in all regions of the world is going to be implemented. Islam is the source of human happiness. We have been saying that the revolution that had happened in Iran in 1979 had three major factors. One was the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini, that played a key role with charisma and specific characteristics of the late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, was very influential in the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The second was the nation themselves, the people, who backed him, who backed the leadership. But what is the turning point, what is the main factor that connects these two, is the third factor, which is the religion and beliefs of the people, Islam. Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi salli ala Islamic rulings were something that people raced for, and Imam rahmatullah alayhi says that the final victory is the time that, inshallah, indirectly and implicitly he says that the time that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam comes and he's going to implement Islamic rulings over the scene of the earth, and all the humanity will benefit from Islamic rulings, and Islam by itself has come for the prosperity and happiness of the mankind. The final victory is then that Islam is going to be widespread in the world. So still we are saying and we are looking at three factors that caused the Islamic Republic to happen. That is the factors of the victory, one of which was Islam and Islamic beliefs. That Imam hopes that, inshallah, in future, when it is going to get connected to the final government of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, Islam will be widespread in the whole world and it will show its effects and fruits to the whole mankind. We wish that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us the tawfiq to understand that time when Islamic rulings are being implemented in the whole world.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
France has been hit by nationwide strikes as protesters voice their opposition to the proposed pension reforms. It is expected that the strikes will continue to impact daily life in France in the coming days. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, for the third time in less than a month, hundreds of thousands of workers across France participated in strikes and rallies to protest President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular plan to force people to work longer before they qualify for a full pension. The latest nationwide mobilization against Macron's assault on French retirement benefits brought at least 750,000 people to the streets, with turnout lower than on January 19th and January 31st. The recent walkouts and marches came one day after the National Assembly began debating legislation that would raise France's official retirement age from 62 to 64 by 2030. Rachel Keck, the first cleaner in France to become a lawmaker, said during a tense debate in Parliament recently, "Those of you who support this reform don't understand how tough jobs are, what it's like to wake up with aching back. You don't understand what it's like to take medication to get through the workday. You don't understand because it's not a world you live in." The leftists continued, garnering applause from fellow opposition lawmakers. During a recent rally in the city of Nice, pensioner Bernard Chevalier echoed Keck, saying that we are worn out by work. He said retirement should be a second life, not a waiting room for death. Opposition to pushing back France's retirement age is widespread, with recent polling showing that approximately 3/4 of the population is against such a move. Nevertheless, many of Macron's allies remain determined to fulfill his campaign pledge to overhaul the nation's pension system. Last week, Macron characterized his effort to hike the retirement age as essential, while Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren claimed that doing so is no longer negotiable. Recently, Labour Minister Olivier Dussopt dismissed opposition lawmakers' accusations that the government is in denial over the scale of protest and doubled down on the supposed need for change. Dussopt told RMC Radio, "The pension system is loss-making, and if we care about the system, we must save it." But as Agence France-Presse reported, some of the government's own experts have said the pension system is in relatively good shape and would likely eventually return to a balanced budget, even without reforms. Reuters reported union leaders and left-wing lawmakers meanwhile say the money can be found elsewhere, notably from the wealthy. Organized labor, for its part, intends to launch repeated waves of mass demonstrations until Macron and others, who insist on the need to cut retirement benefits, are defeated. Philippe Martinez, General Secretary of the General Confederation of Labor, CGT, said recently at a march in Paris, "This reform will upend the lives of several generations. If the government stubbornly forges ahead, we will step up our protest with longer and harder actions." Striking workers in strategic sectors, including electricity production, transportation, and education, disrupted multiple aspects of daily life recently, though to a lesser degree than they did twice last month. Macron's bill faces an uphill battle in the National Assembly. Notably, the New Ecological and Social People's Union, NUPES, a coalition of four left-wing parties recently formed by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, won 131 seats in last June's parliamentary elections, denying Macron's New Liberal Alliance ensemble the absolute majority it needed to ram through his unwanted austerity agenda. However, journalist Marlon Ettinger, citing French Communist Party lawmaker André Cassigan, warned recently that the government might try to pass the reform through a social security financing bill known as PLFRSS, which would allow for a series of constitutional delays that would significantly limit the amount of time deputies can discuss the bill. It would also block the possibility for the opposition to present their own counterproposals. In addition, although Macron has no popular assent nor a parliamentary majority for his reform, he does have constitutional tools he can use to push the package through, Ettinger explained in Jacobin, adding one known as 49.3, after the article of the Constitution which grants the president this power, essentially lets him bypass the National Assembly. The Constitution of the current Fifth Republic grants the president these authoritarian powers to hedge against any popular sentiment that might make its way into the lower house. The use of 49.3 would suspend the debate in the National Assembly, then send the bill directly to the Senate, which is controlled by less Republicans. Laurent Berger, General Secretary of the French Democratic Confederation of Labour, CFDT, told a Parisian crowd recently that concessions offered by the government, such as allowing people who start working early to retire early, are just patches. Berger said increasing the legal retirement to 64 is the core of this reform, and it is deeply unfair. It's a democratic folly for the government to turn a deaf ear to the protest. Another day of action is planned in the near future. Also, Reuters reported a national strike against planned pension reforms reduced France's power supply and disrupted petrol deliveries from French refineries recently. Strikes have been taking place since mid-January as unions protest against the government's plans to make people work longer before retirement. Public transport and schools have also been affected. Total power supply was reduced by about 6.3% or 4.3 gigawatts due to decreased supply at two nuclear reactors and several thermal and hydro plants, data from power utility EDF showed. Nuclear capacity was lowered by 1.8 gigawatts and thermal plants were reduced by 2.3 gigawatts, while hydropower disruption totaled 220 megawatts. No imports were needed at 20 11, after peaking earlier at 2.8 gigawatts, grid operator RTE data showed strike participation at EDF totaled some 30.3% of employees by midday, the utility said. This compares to the midday rate of 40.3% recorded on January 31st. On the refining side, the shipping of petrol products from French sites was interrupted by the strike, Total Energy said. The company added that there was no shortage of petrol at fueling stations and supply levels were generally satisfactory. About 56% of the operators working in the Total Energy's French refineries and depots were on a strike, the company said. At Esso, a subsidiary of ExxonMobil, about 75% of the workforce at the FAS site was on a strike and blocking deliveries, while the Port Jerome site was operating, a CGT spokesperson said.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
More than 1,700 guests attended the National Day reception in the center of Moscow, hosted by the Iranian embassy, to mark the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The reception was attended by top Russian dignitaries, as well as military figures and members of the civil society. Non-Russian diplomats could also be seen at the event.
Basing on objective analysis, I am absolutely sure that now our Russian people with Iranian people should fight together against the great enemy, our common enemy, understanding together each other better, better and better, as well on the spiritual level.
The prominent philosopher says he predicted that modern Iran and Russia would grow closer years ago. They share the same values, interests and both belong to the ancient Eurasian civilization. They also seek to bring an end to years of Western dominance and oppression across the globe.
Iran is truly one of a kind in this world. It has one of the most ancient civilizations, and it continues to live up to that legacy. Despite heavy sanctions and pressure, they have made astonishing achievements in the past four decades. People are high-spirited. Iranians yearn for development. I'm very glad that the relations between Iran and Russia are flourishing. Together we can solve many problems in West Asia and around the world.
According to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, in the last year alone, trade with Iran and Russia has reached $5 billion. The position of the two countries is in tune with a number of international agendas. The two nations oppose the model of a unipolar device and will do everything to defend their sovereignty.
Iran is an example of a harmonious combination of the principles of religion, human rights, and national interests. We maintain a high intensity of political and economic dialogue between our countries. Russian-Iranian cooperation is reaching a qualitatively new strategic level, despite the illegal pressure of unfriendly countries.
The guests of the reception all believed in one thing. The stability of Iran's Islamic Revolution is due to the unquestioning support of people. Iranians are defending their revolution despite constant propaganda, as well as huge funds to overthrow its results.
The anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is commemorated in Russia every year. As the two countries continue to expand ties, Russian political elite pay their respect to Iran. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Okay.
Iranians from different walks of life have participated in the commemoration rally from all parts of the metropolitan Tehran to the iconic Azadi Square to mark and celebrate the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and renew allegiance with the ideals of the revolution.
The Iranian nation toppled the US-backed Pahlavi regime 44 years ago, ending 2,500 years of monarchy in the country. The Islamic Revolution led by Imam Khomeini established a new political system based on Islamic values and democracy.
The celebration was held in Tehran and over 1,400 cities and 38,000 villages around the Islamic country.
We are here to support our country and we are here to tell the U.S. to back off so that we can make more improvements in our country. We're going to support this government, this country forever. We're going to support our supreme leader. So you just have to stop interfering in our affairs. And we want to say that down with the U.S. because you've been the cruelest country in the world.
We celebrate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution to show the world that despite all riots and plots hatched by the enemies, our Islamic Revolution is strong and powerful. We love our leader and the Islamic Revolution and are ready to sacrifice our life for the ideals of our revolution.
Addressing crowds of people at Azadi Square, Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, said West's policy of imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation.
West's policy imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. The United States and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The Iranians managed to make the enemy's plots futile. The West, the U.S. in particular, stands accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region.
The demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country. Analysts believe that after 44 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic establishment, Iran has now been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom seekers and the oppressed nations of the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting 270 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects, to take part in the 13th Ahwaz Oil Show. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are on the list of U.S. sanctions.
We have invited all of the local companies operating in oil well services, instrumentation, and the production of any equipment that's required in the oil and gas industry. They are here to achieve synergy with each other and state-owned firms with the ultimate goal of increasing our oil production.
For decades, Iran relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery from drilling bits to pipelines.
After almost 110 years of dependence on the import of drilling bits, our engineers at Asmari, along with other Iranian firms, have been able to indigenize the bit technology. So we design and manufacture a range of drilling bits locally, and this is thanks to the restrictions caused by sanctions.
With regard to sour service pipes, our company used to import them for its oil-related projects. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel, but after Trump imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, we put our heads together and managed to produce our own anti-corrosion pipelines.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions against Iran in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs. That's why the government in Iran is now making a seismic shift to local manufacturers to rebuild its oil sector, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
About 7 decades ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector, something which experts here describe as another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's economy from the impacts of oil embargoes. Yusuf Jalali, Ahvaz.
In line with the fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television